Smile a While with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and the Cromwell Savings Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. Hometown friends serving your best banking interests in every way. Now here is your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening. And with me once again is radio collector, historian, Ed Corcoran.
Well, tonight I thought we would go back into one of the veteran character actors and bring to the studio Mr. Humphrey Davis, who is currently appearing at the local stage company. And here he is, Nick.
Hello.
It's nice to have you with us. I'm delighted to welcome Humphrey Davis to our program. Mr. Davis is appearing at the Hartford Stage Company in Edward Albee's All Over. And I understand you play the best friend.
I do play the best friend. That's a lawyer who has been handling the legal business of the, we call him the Titan, who is dying. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, very interesting part. It's an interesting play. It's gotten a very strange reception here in Hartford. But to me, it's not a play about death. Everybody's comments that this is a play about death. It's not. It's a play about people who are coming to the end of a period of their lives because they have depended on that man. And if he's not going to be here anymore, what's going to happen to them?
Yeah.
And that's the interesting part of this, because all of these people have their ties to him and to each other. And the dependence that is about to be cut off makes it a very fascinating, tense kind of a period.
I can imagine it would be.
And, of course, to me, the language is marvelous. It's not Shakespeare, but it's about as close to Shakespeare as I've spoken from a modern writer, and that's saying a lot.
Humphrey Davis is here not to talk about his present career, but we're going to go back, about 40 years, Humphrey
right.
Davis. We really are, because we're going to take you right back to the days of the Guy Hedlund Players right here at WTIC.
Across the street.
That's right, over in the Traveler's Building, in the Grove Street Building.
Right up at the top of that place, I think. I think we had a whole floor and one huge room that was, these four studios put together to do the shows in. The musicians had a separate studio. We had a big rehearsal hall. And it was a marvelous, marvelous collection of people.
Are you from Connecticut originally?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I am. I'm from Meriden. And after I finished a bit of schooling in New York, I came back home, and my parents said, well, how are you going to make a living? So I said, first thing is WTIC.
Mm-hmm.
So I came up and met Guy and read for him, and he said, sure, come on in. So I did two shows a week for him there. And in these days of big salaries, we got $5 a show for doing the Guy Hedlund Playhouse. That was a half-hour program. We rehearsed on Monday afternoon, came back on Tuesday afternoon, rehearsed, and then did it on the air.
You know, you mentioned Meriden, and of course, Phillips H. Lord passed away not too long ago. He, too, was from Meriden, wasn't he?
Yes, indeed. He was the son of a Congregationalist minister there, I think. Dr. Lord had a big church on Colony Street. And I never really got too well acquainted with Phillips. He was already creating his, well, radio career, I guess, starting with Seth Parker, which was originally done here at WTIC across the street. And a man named Paul Lucas played the title role for a long time. There's another woman named Eunice something or other who played his wife, but she was a marvelous member of the Hedlund Players, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when the NBC network heard this marvelous show and bought it from Phillips Lord. They took it to New York. But unfortunately, Paul and Eunice weren't taken with it. And they stayed here. And from there, Phillips, of course, went on to Gangbusters and the rest of the things that he did on radio and was very, very successful about it.
Was the Players ever on the network, the Guy Hydland Players at all, do you recall?
Oh, about once a month, we went coast to coast. And that was a real special occasion, usually on the Friday show. We did it Tuesdays and Fridays. And the Tuesday one was usually broadcast over the Yankee network, near the New England stations, mm-hmm. Boston, Maine, whatnot. And but when we got to that coast-to-coast deal, everybody was excited about that one, because in 1934, that was a big deal.
Well, you know, it would be a big deal today.
I'm sure it would.
How did you make your transition from WTIC to New York radio?
Well, that was a strange combination of events. I went into theater right from WTIC. One of the Hedlund Company people recommended me to a producer in Guilford, and I started there, and went from... We actually did 110 different plays in 2 years. And after that, I went into a Shakespeare production on Broadway with Walter Houston, Othello, which was not a success. And then after that, I played with Walter Hampton in An Enemy of the People, which was a mild success. But in both of those plays, oddly enough, there was a man from Georgia who had a Shakespearean repertory company. And he invited me to go south, and we played Shakespearean repertory all through the south, schools and colleges. And it did me in. I was really, I came back and was in bed for a year. Mm-hmm. And when I got back on my feet, the easiest thing I could think of was to try radio in New York, which
you
I
didn't
did.
Have to travel there.
So I started with WHN and a man named Maurice Barrett, who was a remarkable intellect. He wrote practically every word that went on WHN for a solid year, from plays to announcements, commercial announcements, station breaks, weather reports, everything. He turned these all out by himself. And he was an old theater man. He'd been around the theater for years and years as actor and as producer and as manager and whatnot, and it wound up at WHN because that was then Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's voice in New York. Mm-hmm. Later they changed the call letters to WMGM, but it's gone back to WHN at this point, I think. And we did a lot of odd things. One of them was a series of Yiddish programs that were done on Sunday noon called Yiddish Swing. That was in the time when swing music, the BMI ASCAP war was on, and they dug into all those things by Mir Bista Shane and that kind of tune. And there were a couple of girls on that show, the Barry sisters. They were about 16 at the time, and they sounded exactly the same then as they do now, if they still work. I think they do. Mm-hmm. They're still doing nightclub things. They're one of the most remarkable teams of voices that I've heard. Anyway, that was one of the shows that we did there. We did several script things. And from there, of course, I went into other... I had the opportunity and a little bit of money to spread around, and so I went into a thing at the Trans-American Broadcasting Company, which is a recording outfit, really. But it was called Don Winslow of the Navy. Mm-hmm. And the star, Don Winslow, was Raymond Edward Johnson, who later came up as the host, Raymond, on the old Inner Sanctum shows, which is now being done by E.G. Marshall in an entirely different way, I must say, than Raymond Edward used to do it. But the Don Winslow thing was the first running part that I had. I played a character called Admiral Warburton, who had been captured by the villains of the piece at the time and thrown into a dungeon. And when Don finally rescued me. I was shaking and practically falling apart.
I remember. You know, I was a listener at the time. You're a listener right now, Admiral.
But, of course, Transamerican also produced shows like Life Can Be Beautiful. And I got into those, playing a whole series of different parts from, I can't even remember the names of them. Yeah. But they also did Radio's Digest, and a whole series of shows that were not recorded per se, but were network shows.
Well, as long as we're talking about Don Winslow, do you think, Ed, it might be possible to bring Admiral Warburton back to our listening audience?
We've never done this before, Dick. This is the first time ever. Don Winslow of the United States Navy.
All hands on deck for Don Winslow. Stand by for action. Stand by for Don Winslow of the Navy, by the makers of delicious Post Toasties. Yes, shipmates, Don Winslow is on the air, bringing you the exciting adventures of the naval intelligence officers who fight against spies and saboteurs behind the lines so our great Navy can battle the enemy on the front lines. And now, shipmates, all hands on deck for our story. Don and Red are heading for a new assignment. As yet, they have not received their fighting orders. They were just recalled from shore leave and placed aboard a Navy PBY patrol bomber bound for a secret rendezvous somewhere in the Pacific Ocean. While on the way, their giant plane receives the dreaded SSS signal from a large cargo liner, the Redland. That signal means submarine attack. They turn back to go to the liner's aid. They spot the submarine and roar down to the attack. The bombardier sights, presses the trigger on the release cable, and two bombs drop swiftly to the target.
Don, we got it. That sub is cold pig iron now. What a plane, what a crew. It was a direct hit. Yippee! Hey, what's the matter? Why so glum? We got it, don't you understand?
Yes, I know, Red. There was something very strange about that submarine that I don't like.
What do you mean, strange? It's just a mess of scrap iron now. You don't have to worry about that one anymore.
Not for sure, Red.
Well, for Pete's sake, what are you getting at?
Did you notice the size of it?
No, I can't say that I did. What about the size?
It was too small.
Too small? Hey, are you kidding?
No, I'm not. When I first saw the shadow under the water, I thought it might be caused by surface distortion.
Uh-huh.
But when those bombs hit and blew it half out of the water, I was sure. That sub was too small, Red.
Say, what do you expect them to do? Build the sub in standard size for you? It was big enough to torpedo the Redland.
That's just it. There was something more behind the sinking of this one ship, I'm sure.
I don't know. You're going way over my head.
Bombardier to pilot. Bombardier to pilot.
Hold it a minute, Red.
Pilot, go ahead. Just spotted a man in the water. Looks like a survivor from the Redland. He's drifting away from the lifeboat. He'll be lost altogether if we don't signal them to pick him up. Pilot, roger. I'll go down and signal that liquor. They'll reach him. Okay. He's drifting away on a line from the Redland to the wreckage of that sub. Right. I've got it. Say, nice egg lamp. Thanks for the swell run. Pilot to radio.
Winslow to pilot. Winslow to pilot.
Yes, Commander.
I'd like you to go down and pick up that man yourself. I want to speak to him, and I want to get a closer look at the wreckage of that submarine.
We're behind schedule now, sir. I was ordered to get you to the Admiral by 6 hours. If we go down, we'll be way off.
I'll take the responsibility, Lieutenant. This is important.
Right, sir. Anything you say.
Fellows and girls, be sure to be with us every day to keep pace with the adventures of Don and his friend, Red Pennington, as they track down the dangerous enemies of our beloved country. Tomorrow, Don and Red receive special secret orders from Admiral Colby that will plunge them into one of the most thrilling adventures of their entire careers. You'll hear all about it tomorrow. Same time, same station, same call to action. All hands on deck for Don Winslow.
All hands on deck.
Don Winslow of the Navy is presented Monday through Friday by the makers of nourishing Post Toasties, the delicious cornflakes that stay crisp longer in milk.
Don Winslow of the Navy. Well, that takes us back to the 30s, no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get back to our guest Humphrey Davis right after this.
You don't have to wait till Christmas to open this gift from Cromwell Savings, Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. When you join their 1976 Christmas Club, they'll present you with an attractive, clear glass 24.5-ounce ginger jar and cover. You can begin your Christmas Club account right now with weekly deposits from as low as 50 cents or more at any Cromwell Savings or Farmers and Mechanics Savings Banks. Because an account at one is an account at both. And you'll receive 5% annual interest rate when you complete your club deposits in 1976. Stop by the Cromwell Savings Bank, division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank at the corner of Main and West Streets, and at the new Cromwell Plaza office near Kmart. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has offices in Middletown at Main and College and also Washington Street. Other locations include Montville and Colchester. Member FDIC. And now back to Dick Bertel.
Humphrey Davis is our guest tonight here on the Golden Age of Radio. I might point out that Humphrey Davis is appearing as the best friend in the Albee drama All Over, which is now playing at the Hartford Stage Company. And Humphrey Davis, it's great to have you here on the program, because we're talking about shows that we have never talked about. I'll tell you, you've been involved in all of them.
It's a long list. I was really probably one of the people who enjoyed radio more than anybody else I can think of, because there was a great variety of things to do, a great variety of personalities involved, and a tremendous number of very, very talented people.
Writers and actors.
Writers and actors, yes, indeed. So I don't know whether you're interested in a whole catalog of the kind of things that I did, but I fell into, as years went on, I did that for 12 years exclusively. I did nothing but radio from one week's end to the next.
Did you have a respect for the medium?
Oh, yes, indeed. There was a creative thing about radio at its best that I have never seen in any other particular section of show business. There was no personal selfishness. Now, that's maybe a strong way to put it. But cooperation between a director, the cast in the studio, the musicians or organist, whichever it happened to be, and the sound people was absolutely amazing, because the sound, let's take a show like The Land of the Lost.
All right.
That's one I don't think you probably had a chance to listen to. It
no,
was a Saturday
you're right.
Saturday morning show, and it was created by a woman named Isabel Manning Hewson, who wrote children's stories. And it concerned the mystic kingdom under the sea, where all lost objects went to. In the course of that show, the sound man had to create special sounds that would be not natural, but hyper-natural, so that they fit the characters of the lost objects. When you're playing an umbrella and you have to walk along a street at the bottom of the sea, it calls for a special sound.
Mm-hmm.
When you're a hat, it calls for some other kind of a sound to move around. Everyone under the sea traveled in taxi crabs, and they could not sound like motors, but they had to have special propellants. One of my favorite parts there was the thing called Lucullus, Lord of the Lobster Pots. And if you stop to analyze that, lobster is a feasting kind of a dish.
It certainly is.
But old Lucullus, he had claustrophobia.
Uh-huh.
And when he was caught in a lobster pot, there was everything broke loose, and that was one of the real fun things. There was also a section where lost knives and cutlery went to, and we did two of those, and in both of those segments I played Sir Cake Carver, who was a very, very effeminate kind of a delicate blade. And so you can see music and the sound and the actors and the director and the script all had to mesh to make that sort of thing pay off, because the stories were legitimate stories. They all had problems.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear the Sharks gang in West Side Story, we had the Sharks way back in Land of the Lost, who were the villains and constantly threatening the little boy and girl who are traveling around the bottom of the sea. And that kind of creativity is very hard to find these days.
And it seems to me that it was using radio's ability to create imagery at its optimum.
Absolutely. Everyone who listened had to get a picture and had their own picture of what was going on and what these characters looked like. Lucullus, you know, a lobster. this had to create that.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a very specialized group of people working at that. We also had a lot of very special people working in news shows. I'm not talking about the March of Time particularly, but in the Second World War, there was a great deal of off-the-wire news. WMCA had one, for instance, called Five Star Final.
Oh, I remember the program.
Where we would go into the studio at 6 o'clock, and at 6:30 we were on the air. What we did was to take the tear sheets from the teletypes, and the man would sit over there at the side and mark what quotes were being given to the wire services by Churchill or any of the other leaders at the time, and we would go and do them on the air as if I played Churchill, and so I did a lot of his famous speeches and famous declarations.
Mm-hmm.
And but these were right off the top of your head as they handed you these things at the microphone. Now this was really hot news. There were other news shows. For instance, the United Press and Associated Press had radio shows that were done two or three times a week as their correspondents in the Pacific Theater or the European Theater would send in special stories. And those required very, very definite realism and creativity in order to make those work.
We point out every once in a while, because we have a great many young people listening to us, they're fascinated by this whole era, that recordings were not that readily available of these people's voices, and that was the need, that was the reason for the actor.
That's right, that's right. Well, you couldn't get a recording remote pickup from Churchill.
Right, right.
You couldn't get a remote pickup from the Battle of the Bulge or any place on one of the islands in the Pacific. You had to have words that were sent and then translated into action and there was a great following because news at that particular time was of vital importance to an awful lot of people.
It certainly was.
Well, you're really saying then that the radio actor was something special. He wasn't a stage actor or a movie actor. He was radio, and his craft was a little bit different, a little bit harder.
Not necessarily being separate from one or the other of the branches of the field, but combining all of them vocally and intellectually, so that what you did vocally had to have a picture behind it, because if you weren't creating an image in your head, you couldn't do it vocally. At least I could never do it. Charlie Chaplin had a phrase that I used constantly for myself to remind myself of it, when he would write his day by day comedy sequences and go into the control room and watch them. He would say, "I have to watch what the little man is doing. The little man's picture is right in front of my forehead." Well, that was the technique that I used for myself. Anything that was on a paper, immediately I had to find an image for. And if I could see that image here, I could talk like that image to the microphone. And that was my particular technique. I don't know what other people used, but it combines the physical thing and the motion picture technique with the vocal technique. And
were you often cast as a villain?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. I had a whole series of those. One of the most remarkable of them was I got hate mail.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you would. There's no question.
From a show called Life Can Be Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Because Chi-Chi and Papa David were such nice people. And there was one particular character that I played who was rich and nasty and wanted that bookstore only because he couldn't buy it from Papa David. And he foreclosed the mortgage. He stopped the newspaper ads. He did everything that was possible to kill the business of the bookshop and made himself enemies from coast to coast, always being very nice and very sweet and very, very polite and terribly, terribly self-effacing, but nasty.
And was it written so that the audience knew a little more, perhaps, than the other characters about his real?
Oh yes, because that would come out in scenes that Chi-Chi or Papa David were not involved with when he would talk to other people.
It's no wonder you got that hit
there. Yes, indeed.
Well, that was a regular field day. It wasn't about every major actor in New York on that show at one time or other that Life Can Be Beautiful.
Well, not too many, as a matter of fact. And I'm putting myself in that class. The good radio actors were, because again, that was one of those specialized things. You may not know this about LCBB, but there was a time when Chi-Chi was going to have a baby, and the studio was absolutely jammed to the doors with layettes, baby carriages, all kinds of things that a new mother should have, and they came in bales with letters and gifts for the baby. You have no idea. It was one of those things that is impossible now. You wouldn't identify with Kojak and send him a gift if he happened
maybe
to have a headache.
Maybe a toupee or something. You know?
But none of these people, everyone who listened had their own picture of this marvelous Papa David and Chi-Chi, this little orphan girl, and they identified with them. They lived with them, and they waited from day to day to find out what was going to happen next and were they going to come out the way they thought they should come out. And it was a very fascinating personal relationship, which you could never forget. Once you got in front of that microphone, you could never forget that ear was listening to you from coast to coast. That great big ear.
I know it. And it was an unforgiving ear, too.
That's
as a matter
true.
Of fact, that would come up if an actor were sick and had to be replaced. That would become very disturbing to the radio audience.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. No amount of explanation would
take care
of that.
That's right.
Because the voice conveyed an entirely different image.
That's true. That's true.
Very big problem. Yeah. I want to hear from Nick Carter, but we've got to find out what part you played first.
Oh, well, Nick Carter went on for a long time. I think that was about 7.5 years. And in the beginning, I played Nick Carter's father, who was an old policeman named Sim Carter, S-I-M. I don't know what that stands for, Simeon or something of that sort. But he was taken from the old paper books, the magazines, the Nick Carter weeklies. And so that was Nick's connection to the police department. All of his relationships with criminals and whatnot were resolved that way. But later on, they decided that Sim was too old and not active enough, and they changed the character to a man named Lieutenant Riley, who was a very buoyant kind of Irishman and very self-assertive and never quite smart enough. And so Lieutenant Riley was the character that I played most of the time from then on. When I say most of the time, there were times when Riley was not in the script, but then I would play other parts. Usually I did Riley in something else, as minor part or a voice or that sort of thing. Oh, Nick Carter. About 6 months ago, I walked into the 5 and 10 that was on Times Square. And they have a record department in the back of that store. And this thing was going on, and I don't know what I was buying, but I heard the back of my ear theme songs from radio. And I don't know whether that's the record that you use on this show or not, but it had little bits of themes from all of the openings of all the radio shows.
No, I know the record you're talking about. Yeah.
All of a sudden, there came this thing with the organ, pa-pa, and pound, pound, pound on the door, and my voice saying,
Another case for Nick Carter, Master Detective!
I've got that in my collection.
Have you?
Huh?
Well, yes. That's my voice on that thing, and I've nearly floored. I went back and said, play that again, because I never got paid for that.
Oh, that's unfortunate. Let's listen to a Nick Carter adventure, Ed.
Okay, Dick, let's roll the tape.
Case for that most famous of all manhunters, the detective whose ability at solving crime is unequaled in the history of detective fiction. Nick Carter, Master Detective. Tonight's curious adventure,
Missing Harold Ascot. For Nick Carter and the Great Kidnapping Mystery.
Hello?
Hello, Nick. I'm glad I found you in.
Oh, Riley, what is it?
You still say you're not interested in this Tillfield killing?
Well, as a matter of fact, Riley, something's happened since you spoke to me about it. I've changed my mind.
Oh, so you've heard already?
Heard? What?
About the big Postal Express robbery down on Front Street. That's where I'm calling from.
I know, that's news to me. What do they get, Riley?
$40,000 in negotiable bonds. Right out of the vault, Nick.
Not bad.
Yes, and this is the interesting part.
Yeah?
Do you know who those bonds were being shipped to? Michael Stillfield.
Stillfield? Okay, Riley, thanks. I'll be right down. Well, Patsy, this thing gets more interesting by the minute. Let's go.
Here you are, Nick. Hello, Patsy.
Hello, Lieutenant.
Well, Riley, let's have a look.
Sure thing, Nick. Come on inside. Now, this is Mr. Johnson, Nick. He's in charge of the express office.
How do you do?
So glad you came, Mr. Carter. Nothing like this has happened in the 30 years I've been with the company.
Well, I suppose there's always a first time, Mr. Johnson.
That's the vault over there, Mr. Carter.
No, thanks. You certainly don't come any finer.
That's true, Mr. Carter. Absolutely burglar-proof. Or so we thought.
Was anything else taken?
No, just the bonds. And they're as good as cash, you know.
When did you discover that they were missing?
This morning. They were put in that vault last night. I watched the bookkeeper do it myself.
I see. And you were the one who closed the vaults?
That's right. I closed it and adjusted the time mechanism myself.
Well, seems to be intact.
That's just it, Mr. Carter. I can't understand it. Neither the vault lock nor the time attachment have been tampered with.
It looks like the devil's own work.
It's absolutely incredible, Mr. Carter. But there you have it. The safe was open and the bonds are gone.
Well, what do you make of it, Nick?
There aren't many men who could have pulled off this kind of a job.
Oh, you're right there, Nick. As a matter of fact, I don't know anybody but Nick Carter could have done it. He's that handy with locks of all kinds.
You have some idea, Mr. Carter?
You say the bonds were put in the vault last night.
Yes, that's right.
About what time would you say?
Well, we received them from the west on the 5 o'clock
hey,
train.
Did you say from the west?
Well, yes, they came from Colorado.
And they were addressed to Michael Stillfield?
That's right. And they were put in the vault a little after 5. And as you already know, that's the last we were seen of them.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I don't think we need bother you any further.
I do hope you'll be able to track down that thief.
It's more than a thief you've put me on the track of. The man we're looking for, Mr. Johnson, is a murderer.
Nick Carter. Oh, boy, that's a great story. I'm glad to know that you're the voice there on the other end of the door.
Sunday afternoon when it was played, with the shadow. And
yes,
the big band radio.
It was 5:30 to 6 or somewhere in that time. Yeah.
We'll get back to our guest, Humphrey Davis, right after this.
Need a new automobile so that you can be assured of dependable transportation throughout the winter months? Are there home improvements that you feel are necessary at your home? Or perhaps you have some financial obligations you'd like to clear up now as we approach the holiday season. Whatever the worthwhile reason, The folks at Cromwell Savings Bank or Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank invite you to stop in and chat with one of their loan officers. Perhaps the solution to your particular problem is a personal loan or a home improvement loan arranged to suit your needs. You'll find a friendly loan officer at any one of their six offices. Cromwell Savings Bank has two, one at the corner of Main and West Streets in Cromwell or at the new Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has four offices to serve you, two in Middletown and branches in Montville and Colchester. Stop in soon. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender. And now again, here's Dick Bertel.
Humphrey Davis is with us tonight, who has been a radio actor for many years, a stage actor now, and is appearing, as a matter of fact, at the Hartford Stage Company in the Edward Albee drama All Over. He plays the part of the best friend. We're not talking about that tonight, though. We're talking about the golden years of radio. And you played every show there ever was, Humphrey Davis.
Just about.
I'm just going over this list that you provided us with, and we have everything. The Cavalcade of America. Did you ever work with Orson Welles?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Orson was in the Philip Morris Playhouse. And that was in the Charles Martin production, mm-hmm. which was done usually at the New Amsterdam Theater roof. And Orson did some strange things there. a lot of the people from the Mercury played in that company. And we did some very good shows. Orson, at one time, well, there was a man named Eustace Wyatt, who was an old British actor. This is one of the things I'd like to come back to later on. But Eustace was a very good actor, but he had bad eyes. And in order to see his cues and his lines, he would take what we call now magic markers, mm-hmm. but they were very strange then, only artists used them. And he would mark his cues, the speech before he spoke, with an orange color, right over the type, so that he could see the words through the color. His own would be done in a pink, right over the lines, over the words on his page, so that when the orange came up, he knew, I'm coming next, and the pink was his speech. Mm-hmm. Now, he did this all through his script, and Orson knew this, of course. So, one night, Eustace had a particularly heavy part, and Orson arranged with the electrician who was doing the theater, the New Amsterdam Theater, of course, had an audience and was completely equipped with stage lights. So Orson made a deal with the electrician, and as soon as the show went on, they threw on the straw lights, which completely wiped out all the color on Eustace's script, and he had no idea where he was going. Orson had himself a laugh. But fortunately, the lights came on at the right time, right kind of lights, and Eustace was able to go on. That was also the time I was on the show where Orson came in very late. He hated to rehearse these things. Mm-hmm. And he came in late. And he always required that he have a music stand for his script. Nobody else ever did, but he did. So he put his script up on the thing, and he started to talk to Charlie Martin about something, and went, big gesture, and knocked the script right off the thing, all over the stage, right in the beginning of this operation. And Martin, his hair stood right up on end, because it would have not only have made a tremendous racket picking the thing up, but it would have held the show up for 5 minutes. Sure. So as he started yelling for volunteers to get the script together, Orson calmly picked another script out of his back pocket and went right on with what he was doing.
Did you ever do any writing?
Oh, yes. Yes, I did. One of the shows that I wrote consistently for, of course, was Nick Carter. I did a series of scripts for them. And wrote myself in, nice juicy parts.
Of course.
And another one was one called The Black Castle, which was also done on the Mutual Network and originated in New York with an amazing actor named Don Douglas. Don played the wizard of the Black Castle, who was the host, sort of the Raymond of this eerie place. But he also played at least 4 to 5 other parts in the show. Naturally, everybody had to be male. But you could write up to 5 or 6 characters for him, and as long as they were definite enough for him to find the breaks from one to the other, and the sound effects could give him a bridge from one to another, he could handle them. It was a remarkable job of, what would you call it? It's a it's a remarkable performance.
I guess so.
And he did that for 26 weeks. And I think I wrote most of the script for him for that. It was on Mutual.
That man today is suffering from schizophrenia.
No, indeed he is not. He's from Texas. If you met him, you would think he was right off the ranch someplace. Mm-hmm, and he is out in California, and occasionally he does himself a Western picture here or there. He doesn't have to work anymore. Mm-hmm. And so he's still around.
Is it possible to hear the Black Castle?
Yes, Dick, we do have one, and it's just as we said, it's a very amazing show, and one of a kind, really. Nothing else quite like it on the air, Dick.
WOR Mutual presents Don Douglas in The Wizard of the Black Castle.
Welcome, friends, to the Black Castle. Come, follow me, please, for again we visit the wizard who dwells yonder in the great hall. Now, up these steps to the iron-studded oaken door which yawns wide on rusted hinges, bidding us enter. Follow softly down this long stone-walled corridor. Music, do you hear it? It is he, sitting before the ruined old organ, clutching the keys with his ancient, bony fingers. Raven, see? Wait, it is well to stop, for here is the wizard of the Black Castle.
Ah, yes, I see you. Good evening, good evening. You're on time, I see. Good, good. Diablo, up you go, away. Up to your perch in the rafter. Yes. Yes, that's a good word. Now, the strange story of escape to death. It is that hour when the city sleeps. In the residential section, all the homes are dark, all except one from which a faint light glows. Suddenly, the stillness of the night is shattered by the shrill shriek of a police whistle. Another is heard, and then another, and another, and another. A frantic, panic-stricken man leaps from the shadows and races down the street. The police whistles now sound on all sides. He is cornered. Ah, the house with the light. It is his only hope, his last chance to escape. Up the step he bounds and into the vestibule. The police are now in close pursuit. Then flashlights are turning the shadowy corners into day and the vestibules into glaring traps. Yes, glaring traps. In desperation, the hunted man presses the button. Ah, ha, ha.
Good evening. I'm sorry to trouble you, but I'm looking for Mr. Brown.
You may come in.
Thanks. Is this Mr. Brown's home?
You have come to the right place.
Well, I am lucky. That's why they call me lucky, I guess.
Follow me.
Yeah, sure.
Through this door. Honorable sir, this man is looking for Mr. Brown.
What? Mr. Brown?
So he says.
Yeah. I'm looking for Larry Brown. He's a buddy of mine.
Why would you think he is here?
Well, this is the address he gave me.
Pardon, honorable sir. The police are in the vicinity. Perhaps they look for someone. Oh, the police are searching for someone, eh? Is it you?
Me? Nah. Why would the cops be looking for me?
Yes. Why, indeed. It is probably the police, honorable sir. Yes, searching for someone, no doubt. Doubtless they saw you run up these steps, eh?
Hey, wait. Give me a break, will you? Come on, give me a chance, please. Please.
All right. Send them away, Nero. As you say, honorable sir.
Now,
Sit down. Make yourself at home.
Thanks. Say, thanks a lot.
Protestations of thanks are not necessary.
Hey, this is some layout you got here. Yes, sir. This joint got some little dough, huh?
Your admiration is flattering. Is it that you want to remain till morning?
Oh, no. I'll be out of your way in no time at all. Them coppers will be gone in a minute.
It was rather ingenious, your asking for Mr. Brown to gain admission.
Yeah, I'm pretty smart cooking when it comes to using my noodle.
They will not be expecting you at your residence?
No, I'm too smart for that. Nobody knows where I live. When I'm home, they know me under another name. I just disappear once in a while, and nobody thinks twice about it.
Good. That is excellent, most excellent. Nobody knows when you disappear.
Yeah, it works okay. Say, what's your racket?
Racket? I do not comprehend. You ain't half, that's all. I mean, what's your swindle? Say, you gotta have one the way you gave me the hand here. I, sir, am a scientist.
Well, what do you know about that? One of them guys that fools around with rabbits and chemicals and that sort of stuff, huh?
Yes, you are right, my new friend. You shall know more of my work. They are gone, honorable sir. They were seeking a sneak thief. Ah, that is good.
Yeah, that's enough. Well, I'll be off, I guess. Thanks a lot for the lift, Professor.
Sit down, my friend. I should like you to remain for a while.
No, not tonight, thanks. Some other time I'll drop around and we'll cut up a few stories together.
Nero, he stays. Yes, honorable sir.
Hey, what's the idea?
I shall tell you. You are a most fortunate young man. I am conducting an experiment. I need badly the help of a man, and I did not know where or how to get one until you, with the fortunate assistance of the police whistles, arrived at my door.
Oh, ain't no good at your racket, Professor.
You are exactly what I need. You are weakling, undernourished, and cowardly. You are the perfect type. And no one will miss you.
The Black Castle, as written by our guest tonight, Humphrey Davis. And we'll be back right after this.
In an age of changing and expanding bank services, two hometown friends and neighbors have now joined together to serve you better. That's right. Now the Cromwell Savings Bank has joined with Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank to offer even greater convenience to customers at any one of their six locations. An account at either bank is an account at both. This means that these two hometown friends can now serve your best interest in every banking way. In addition to a number of savings plans designed to suit individual needs, personal loans, home improvement loans, personal checking accounts will also be available commencing January 1st. So stop in soon and apply for your personal checking account. The Cromwell Savings Bank Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has two locations, at the corner of Main and West Streets and the new Cromwell Plaza office near Kmart. Farmers and Mechanics has offices in Middletown at Main and College Streets and also on Washington Street. Other locations include Montville and Colchester. Member FDIC and an equal housing lender. And now once again, Dick Bertel.
Humphrey Davis is our guest here on the Golden Age of Radio, and before we say goodnight, and unfortunately we are running out of time, I'd like to find out a little bit about the last days of radio for you. When did you begin to realize that it was over?
Well, that happened, I think it was in the beginning of the 40s,
mm-hmm.
when Jock McGregor, who was the director of Nick Carter, and he had never really been a professional actor, a round actor on the stage. But he always had ambitions to be that. Came to me and asked if I would help him in a series that he was going to do of television experimental shows, experimental television shows, at the General Electric Station in Schenectady. They were experimenting there mostly, not with content, but with lights. Because the first television show I did was at the Wanamaker store downtown New York.
Dumont studio. All the sets were about 6 feet wide, and they were pieces of scenery tacked against the wall. And one set after another went around the room, so that you had a chair in front of this door, and that was the living room. And over there you had a sofa in front of a window, and that was another room. And over here was a kitchen table, and behind there was a stove, and that was the kitchen. Nothing elaborate, believe me.
Mm-hmm.
But the lights were so hot that the cameramen, who were in the middle of the studio and just shifted their cameras around from one place to another, had to wear pith helmets. We didn't have that privilege. And this heat in the studio at Wanamaker's went up to 120 or 125 before the show was over. And that was a problem, definitely. So up at General Electric, we were experimenting with lights. And Jock was doing this series for them because he was an engineer on the side. He was trained to be an engineer, and they knew it. So we did all kinds of things there for about 10 weeks with different lighting effects. We even had lights that had water-cooled jackets around them. And in the middle of this show where I was doing an audience participation kind of thing, all of a sudden the pipe broke and we had a waterfall down in front of the cameras.
Incredible.
But that was the beginning of it. And from there on, the Kraft Theater was one of the first ones that was done. This was also in a room with the sets around the wall in a mm-hmm. place called Studio 3K at NBC. And I did a play with that was made famous by Charles Laughton called Payment Deferred. And I think we rehearsed for 2 weeks to do a one-hour program. And it was murder, sheer murder, believe me, because the money was not enough to support my family with. And I was pretty apprehensive about this whole business. So I stayed with radio as long as I could milk it and let the other people get in on the ground floor, because almost immediately the house was built over them and they were forgotten. And new people came on and it became an entirely different thing. But Kraft was one of the first experimental shows, and it remained for a long, long time the top dramatic show on television.
Humphrey Davis, I've thoroughly enjoyed our getting together tonight, and I know there are many stories that we haven't even touched on, but time won't permit it. And if you've been as fascinated by our guest as I have, then I suggest that you get over to the Hartford Stage Company, because Humphrey Davis will be appearing in the production of All Over by Albee until December the 7th.
December the 7th is right.
And Humphrey Davis, thanks again so much for being with us on the Golden Age of Radio tonight.
It's a pleasure.
Until next time, this is Dick Pertell.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good night.
Young family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by CAMA.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Cromwell Savings Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. Hometown friends serving your best banking interests in every way. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bob Chirago and Dick Bertell.
Broadcasting from New York City, the Lucky Strike program, starring Jack Benny with Mary Livingston, Phil Harris, Rochester, Dennis Day, and filling in.
A dancing program from the Paradise Restaurant in the Great White Way.